Whoa. Look at that. Is that a...
built out of a cute Starbucks.
The one with the flowers on it, or... oh, no, that one. This is episode 4 of The Other Ganges.
Yeah. He's got a microphone built in that simulates a stand-up bass sound. You plug it in, it sounds like a full stand-up bass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
He found some genius in California who created the process of him. Just issued a challenge.
Someone do this.
Yeah.
I love these ones with flowers on them too.
Yeah.
What is the kind of people it is?
Yeah.
It's all round.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've mentioned before that music was an intrinsic part of my family life from the start, and it was the same for my dad. We've heard a little about his time playing gigs at the classic Salt Spring Island pubs, the old Harbor House Hotel, and Moby's, of course. For me, my dad's stories of the musical side of the island are conflated with my impressions of culture on Salt Spring in the late 60s and 70s. To say that there was a lot going on societally in North America around then is a comical understatement. And the reverberations of those huge cultural shifts resulted in a very interesting mix of groups expressing what they believed in over on the island. That's right, this is the episode with hippie content. But first... Pioneering spirit is a common thread amongst those who chose to come to Salt Spring in this period. The island was a magnet for those who felt othered in their own societies, for a plethora of reasons. It's funny to me that even in a society built of people who saw themselves as the other, cliques and groups still formed. We are such social creatures and we cling to identity so very hard. Here's John Grain, who we've heard from before. So I know you talk about this a little bit in your book as well. You have a little a section talking about kind of like when you first arrived, but
yeah.
Can you give me a little bit of your recollections, like, because you remember coming from the mainland and then moving to Salt Spring. Do you sort of remember being someone who was not born on Salt Spring? Like, did you kind of feel like there was a cultural or community difference between like you and the other sort of island kids?
Well, yeah, it was quite remarkable, actually, because I was coming from a relatively urban area on the outskirts of Vancouver as a pubescent or prepubescent young boy, coming into a community that was largely farm-based. And I suppose the biggest thing was that I didn't really have anything in common with anybody there, or they didn't with me, whatever the case may have been. My first recollection was how much I loved being there in terms of the closeness I got to nature. Mm-hmm. I loved the ocean and I loved the forests, and I would wander as a kid. Every day after school, I'd just go out and I'd wander for hours until it got dark, and it was just one of those things that it was totally new and foreign to me, and which I fell in love with, I guess.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a big thing. People talk about Salt Spring in relation to kind of the relationship with nature, or like living off the land, like subsistence farming and things like that. That's like a very big collective memory, I think, that I'm coming up against. I know you haven't lived on the island for a while, but I feel like that's one of the biggest things that has kind of been a conversation around how things have changed just environmentally over the decades, which I think is really interesting, that was one of the defining factors in the 50s and 60s and 70s or however. But now, just since there's been environmental shifts, it's not possible to live that way anymore, and it's kind of changed the character of the island in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I can imagine it has.
Mm-hmm. Because I know you have some sections in your book. I really loved like reading the sections where you're talking about your connecting with nature, your learning how to sort of live in conjunction with the natural environment of the island and that kind of stuff. I feel like that's a really cool thing that draws people together across, you know, because there are other sort of dividing factors culturally with the people who come to the island. I think that's one thing that kind of draws them together.
Right.
Because I know you talk a little bit about, you know, there were quite a few different groups of people living on the island at the time that you arrived, right?
Right, there were.
Yeah, and was it sort of
that was sort of geographical to a certain degree.
That's interesting.
In terms,
yeah.
Could within a small community like Salt Spring, mm-hmm. The geography of the area was such that, you know, there wasn't a great deal of transportation or effective transportation. Not that many people even owned cars when I first got there, although you'd think that would be strange, but nevertheless, that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have a car, you simply got a ride with somebody else, or you stood on the road or you started walking to town and you got a ride with somebody. So, you know, in one respect, you didn't really need a vehicle, and in another respect, it sort of stopped people from moving as well.
That's true. So then in terms of the geographical layout of the island at that point, it was like, you know, who was living where at that point?
Well, it was sort of, there was the Fulford group of people. There was a group of families that had been there for a long time and really hadn't moved very far from that general area, the southern part of the island. There was sort of the Ganges community, which, you know, was sort of where, you know, all the shops and everything are, and the sort of the center, the commercial center of the community. And then there was sort of the north end Vesuvius groups of individuals who again, you know, had been there for a long time, and probably their families had been as well, and simply it's just the way it was. You know, there was the Fernwood group of people and the Fernwood families, and there would be the, you know, the Vesuvius families and the Central families and the Fulford families, and not a lot of moving back and forth between the two.
Bill Graham is an example of another kind of pioneering spirit. Brian and I drove up to his property one morning during our visit, winding down island roads lined with lush evergreen trees and the occasional glimpse of red, gnarled arbutus tree trunks when we skirted the coast. Bill met us at the edge of his property and walked us through the spaces he's created there. A hand-built cabin, a chicken coop, pastures for Icelandic sheep, an art space, even a Japanese tea house.
It was a chicken we had once.
Uh-huh.
Really?
And when we, when our kids were in university, and beginning university, we bought a big 50-foot wooden schooner that was partially finished, and we finished it off, and we sailed around the Pacific for several years. Mm. And this was the Miss Shiriri is the figurehead, and that's Miss Chickpea in her arms.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
So Miss Chickpea was eaten by an owl.
Oh no!
Before we left.
Miss Chickpea.
And I was in the process of drawing up specifications for a special chicken box on deck. So I was glad to be relieved in some respects. So I carved Miss Chickpea and she came with us.
Oh, that's so sweet.
And yeah.
I can't even imagine what a nautical chicken would have been like.
Right.
As we wandered the trails, he told us about his land and also his story.
All right, this is beautiful.
It is.
Well, when we first came here in the, late 1970s, we had a travel trailer with us. We had been come from the Okanagan where I was teaching, and we wanted to return to the coast. And so we had three children at that time, just little guys. And so when we came one year and we bought the property, which had a road roughed in and had a well capped. That was all there was. And we came the next year in the spring and cut down some trees and planted.
so cute.
And Luna.
You are so funny.
Luna is a young and very enthusiastic Labrador-looking pup who becomes a shadowy blur racing around us as she crashes in and out of the trees during my recording. She might resurface here and there, but she is always a welcome addition.
We planted some fruit trees, and then we came back after I finished teaching and started in. And the first thing we built was the pump house, 16 feet by 16 feet. And we took the dirt out from there, and we leveled it off, and we planted the parked the travel trailer in front of it. And we lived there for a winter.
Wow.
While in the meantime, we had been up in the Okanagan, cut a whole bunch of poles up in the high country and shipped them down here with all our worldly goods in the back of a trailer. And we built this log cabin. And that was our first thing that we did. And that took a year and 3 months and 2 days, as my wife would tell you.
Of course, counting down. I was going to say, how was that first winter? That must have been challenging.
Well, it was. But you know, we read Little House on the Prairie books to the kids, and we had a washer dryer, and we had light, and we had electric heat. And compared to the Little House on the Prairie kids, we were really well off, right? And it snowed like stink. I mean, it was a real adventure for them.
I can imagine. Yeah. That would have been, yeah, quite a shift. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not only that, but people all around us were doing very similar things. Mm-hmm. So although we were not back to the landers in terms of smoking and partying, we were more the university graduate type people who did it.
So then was this sort of area, like all around here, was there a few other people who were kind of doing that same thing?
Oh yeah,
thing,
nearly or? Everybody on this street was in some version of it. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Reynolds Road people, the Reynolds of Rodents, as we called them, and these were the Iron Mountain folk up here. It was an interesting time. It was hard work. A lot of people didn't make it or struggled along as best they could. And we had our troubles, but we just kept on working. And 40 years later, I've never really stopped.
Yeah, apparently we're still having work happening here today. So. So this here, this is the first sort of property.
And it, I've added to it and added wings and thing at the back to it over time.
Okay.
And the second thing we built was we brought our goats with us and our chickens with us.
Oh, yeah.
And so we built a barn. This is Mark II. We expanded it and put concrete in it and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
But this is, and then later on I added what we call the atrium, this front section here.
Here pretty much, you know, since the original decision to move and start building, you must have witnessed a lot of sort of like community and cultural changes on the island in the time that you've been here, because there's been a lot of shifts, especially, I mean, more in the cities or the towns. But
yeah, well, the thing is, we were part of a shift.
Mm-hmm.
There was loggers and fishermen, farmers before that, and they resented all the hippies who showed up and didn't want to just camp in the bush. And then we were part of the back of the lander generation, and all of them resented us.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even now the older families, they look down their nose just a little bit because we're newcomers. We may have been here for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very interesting. I belonged to the hiking club until fairly recently. And, you know, you'd meet all these people and they'd say, "So how long have you been on the island?" And I'd say, "So, well, how long have you been here?" "Oh, 5 years." And I'd say, "Oh, well, you know, just, you know, I guess around 40 years. And they'd say, "Oh." But 40 years goes by pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And our kids have grown up on the island, and they went off to university, paid their own way through, and we've never had money. I mean, I did not work and earn a pension as such.
Mm-hmm.
So we have always continued that back to the land idea of being self-sufficient. That it's not just an economical thing to grow your own food. Or cut your own trees down, to make your own lumber, to make your own firewood, whatever. There's a philosophical idea behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the important thing. You may not fully understand what it is you're doing, but you're living that life all the same.
Mm-hmm.
I've just finished reading a book by Wendell Berry, who's an ecologist in the States. And he talks about the two different kinds of people, especially who came west in the United States as part of the colonization process. And some of them came to get rich as fast as they could. They used the soil up, they cut trees down, they dug the dirt out of the ground, and then they moved to Florida. And then there was others who came to settle and to stay and to create their farms, make the soil better, grow good food, and live that life. And we see it today too, right? It's, I don't know how long, but we're trying to be that side of things.
Mm-hmm. It is, it's a huge philosophical difference in how your relationship to the land and the environment.
Yeah, yeah. I know all these trees that we're walking through.
Of groups, here comes a word I've often seen associated with Salt Spring, a word used both in a positive, admiring sense and also as a definite pejorative. The word is hippies. In an era where counterculture was on the rise, where young people were looking for identity and feeling increasingly more disenfranchised from the world of their parents, the hippie movement was a refuge for some, a political gathering point for others. Several people I spoke to had thoughts and recollections of this era, spanning many different perspectives. One of them was my aunt, Maya, my father's eldest sister.
Okay, my name is Maya Halliday, And this is fine. I do understand that anything that I say may and probably will be held against me. So
perfect.
We can probably carry on from that cheery note.
I'm going to let her tell her story herself, as she tells me. We're sitting in her basement suite. She's just played me Joni Mitchell's song Woodstock to get me in the right headspace. She echoes the chorus as it drifts out to fill the space between us.
And so was there, like, do you remember that there was a lot of discrimination, like, between hippies and the other people who were living on Salt Spring at that time?
Or? Totally.
Oh, really?
Totally. Ooh. Yeah. And we called them either the hard hats or the orcs. Hmm. Like, you know, from the Tolkien.
Like Lord of the Rings.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. The orcs, the working men with their lunch kits and their hard hats and cans of beer, driving along in their convertibles, trying to pick us up. And we would just laugh at them. But yeah, there was a lot of discrimination, a lot. And I know that back then quite a few people didn't like me very much, or my dad, because I came over with seven other people from a house that we had all been renting on Fourth Avenue, which was the, you know, hippie hangout in Vancouver back then. And that was totally, that came about every Sunday, every third Sunday of the month, we would all, like all seven of us in the house, get together and either smoke some really good pot or do a hit of acid. Mm-hmm. And then we would walk over to Stanley Park, quite a long walk, but we were young and healthy. And we would walk all over the park and have really deep discussions, such as, I remember one time we saw this flower bed and it was so beautiful and there's all these tulips. And I remember I bent down and I looked at it and I saw the way the light shone through the veins in the tulip. But then I thought, oh my God, you guys, are these real or are these artificial flowers? And everybody's leaning over them, trying to feel them and smell them and figure out if they were or not. And the funny thing was, the reason we had a hard time with it was because they looked so perfect that it didn't look as if they could be natural, because natural things have beautiful imperfections. But these, of course, were probably very highly bred. You know, strains of all these different
premium
flowers. Yeah. But still, like, to have a whole bunch of people who are all going to university at the time leaning over all these flowers trying to figure out if they're plastic or not, there's just something kind of hilarious about that. But we all fell in love with nature in that way. You know, all of our walks, we would find something that really got us going, and we had the most amazing conversations. And one day, I said, hey, you know, my dad's got 30 acres on waterfront on this place called Salt Spring Island. And everybody, oh, man. And I says, yeah, we could start off by camping out in the big meadow, and there's tons of oysters and clams. We could live off those, have fires on the beach at night and everything. And so sure enough, a couple of months later, we all arrived on Salt Spring. That wasn't our value system, to look at something and try and make it into something that could make money for us. No, it was really appreciating things for exactly what they were.
And yeah, that, like, the
more interacting with the land and living off the land than trying to interact with like the economy and money
this,
and that kind
this
of thing.
This is it. Try and grow and weave and build what we need for ourselves as far as we could. The only problem with all these Vancouver hippies showing up en masse on Salt Spring, none of us brought shovels or coveralls. We didn't have a clue how to grow anything. And I remember I got some seed potatoes from some planting place one time. And they said, oh, you just cut them up, you know, where these eyes are, and then you just bury them in the soil. And I thought I did it right, but nothing ever grew. So in the fall, I dug up the seed potatoes, and I served them for supper one night. I wasn't about to admit failure.
It's still potatoes. Yeah, exactly.
It was a little soft, shriveled. But yeah. And then, you know, Salt Spring. It's still, I wonder if they still have the Beaver Point boogies at Beaver Point Hall.
Oh, at the hall. I don't know. My dad was talking about, when we drove by it the other day, he was talking about the bean suppers they had at Beaver Point Hall.
And at Fulford Hall and at Central Hall, like some really wonderful bands played there. And I believe your dad was a guest drummer for Chilliwack out at Fulford Hall one time. He was 9 years old. He was so cute with his long hair shaking, and he was good, really good, very talented musician.
I feel the need to intercede here and say that there is a long-running family urban legend involving the Bangerts and the band Chilliwack. I couldn't find anything besides these legends to provide context to the stories, but I will choose to believe that they are real, and I will hold them in my heart and always be keeping an eye out for more evidence of my 9-year-old father guest drumming for the band Chilliwack.
Your dad, very, very smart man. And at the same time, that music was so creative, like you'd never seen in the 50s, ever. And art got creative, like the light shows got going too. So you'd have this kaleidoscopic experience going on all around you. Everybody is pretty much higher than a kite. And the dancing, when you look back at it, it wasn't dancing. They were just waving around and fringes flying and whatnot. So, but that wasn't the point. The point was having the experience. And then there were people like our brother Alf. He never danced, but he leapt up in the air. You could see Alf. He would go around like the outside of the dance floor, and he leapt like, it was like he was feet above everybody else, just up and down, and he just, hey, man, as he went by. Okay, so what else did I want to get on here? Oh, yeah, rock and roll.
Of course. The other one.
Well, see, it all ties in. You couldn't have had one without the other. You know, I don't know if you could call a song like that rock and roll. Like, there was a whole new genre of music. It wasn't really folk music. It wasn't really rock and roll. It wasn't really blues. What are you going to call it? It was like the 60s music. And I thought it was pretty darn good, a lot of it. Yeah,
and that probably had a huge impact on the culture of everyone on the island at that point in history too. Like you were saying with Joni and all in Woodstock, and how that idea of having like a group consciousness with other people around the world and across the continent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and that was what gave us this tremendous hope for humanity, is that we're going to have to somehow develop more of a group consciousness than we have. And the beautiful thing about that kind of group consciousness, it didn't deprive any person of their individuality. In fact, it made us more individual. It's sort of paradoxical. Do you see where I'm trying to get at?
Mm-hmm.
like you don't have to lose who you are just because you're on a very similar sort. It's I guess I hate to use this word spiritual, but that's really what it was.
The time of year, or maybe it's the time of man, I don't know.
Yeah, there was a lot of people, a lot of the old hippies, who got a hold of a little piece of land or a bigger piece of land, depending on what they could afford. And they actually learned how to till the soil and grow really, really good stuff. They grew a lot of pot and everything too, but so what?
It's know? Part of it, yeah.
Really, it was... The whole idea of it being illegal was so idiotic to us then. I would have never believed that it would have taken till 2018 for it to become legal.
Yeah, can you imagine? Oof.
And that's where, like, we began bartering things. The son of the local newspaper owner, Frank Richards, his son started making sandals. And this other older native lady, she was making mukluks, like leather boots that came up to the knee with long fringes. And all of us wanted a pair of those. All of us. And I remember saying to Huey, you remember our friend Huey, don't you? He was funny. And I said, Huey, the thing I love about her moccasins is that no two pair are the same. And he says, no one pair is the same. And it was true. Because again, there's that sort of naturally imperfect thing that happens when you get away from machining things and whatnot. But I was a very proud owner of a pair of those mukluks. Yeah.
I love that there was, yeah, like a bartering economy going on.
Of course, not everyone felt the same way about the waves of newcomers arriving on the island.
That definitely, I feel like my perception growing up of Salt Spring was sort of biased in that direction because my, I have family members who left the mainland to come to Salt Spring in the 60s to be part of the sort of the hippie movement that was growing there, you know, out of a desire to get out of what was happening on the mainland culturally at that point. So that's kind of the memories that I had of how people would talk about Salt Spring back in the day. It was as kind of a haven for counterculture and people who wanted to not, like, purposefully not engage with things that were happening perhaps in the mainstream that they didn't agree with. Which is really interesting. So what do you recall sort of the primary cultural movements that were happening on Salt Spring? I know the hippies are like notorious, but there's a few things happening at that time, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, the so-called hippie movement, the counterculture was, it came from a broad source of things. I mean, it was not only the Vietnam War that was creating groups of, I'll say draft dodgers for the sake of anything better. There was a group of people that came to the island simply just to get away from the United States, mm-hmm. whether legally or not. There was a very strong. I recall in the later 60s that I left the island for 6 months when I finished high school in 1968, and I came back 6 months later, and the island had changed drastically because. In that short period of time, the use of recreational drugs had mushroomed, if you excuse the expression. and so recreational drugs, when I left, were sort of the things that happened in other places. Mm. When I got back 6 months later, my friends, a lot of them were involved with marijuana products, LSD, mescaline, hashish, that sort of drug culture. And it was largely based around the use. Social events were largely based around the use of that.
Hmm.
And that was really quite a shock for me when I got back. There were a lot of folks that were simply just running away, and a lot of people who had arrived on the island who had crossed, not a lot, but there were some people who had crossed the border, which was easy to do in those days, illegally from the San Juan Islands. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people who were squatting in the forests and up in the isolated areas of the islands. There's not many of those left anymore, but in those days there were. You could live quite happily on your own in the hills and not see another soul. The climate was perfect. You could sustain yourselves quite easily from the gifts of the forest and the sea and the farmland. So that was quite different. That was an interesting perspective.
It's hard to imagine, I think, when you're not, you know, from trying to look back at how that was. Did that sort of, was there still kind of a clash between the people who came here for the counterculture and then more of the laboring communities on the island?
You know, there really wasn't that much of a clash, surprisingly enough. Like any community, there will be the sort of the redneck sort of, you know, the bulldozer drivers and the truck drivers, you know, those sort of stereotypes we have of people who may be less understanding. But you would find when you sat down with them that they really did understand, and in some cases, in many cases, in fact, they were quite excited about the fact that someone really was able to break free of the bonds of conformity and try different things to that extent.
That's really interesting. That's a cool perspective. Yeah. Okay. And so when you were there, your father was a school teacher at that point when you were there. I know my dad remembers your father as a teacher. Yeah, he said he really liked Mr. Graham as a teacher. So did that, you, that must have really changed your perspective of like trying to kind of fit into the community as when you were attending school, right? Because it's kind of different when that's the dynamic in the classroom.
Yeah, just before we go into that, I just wanted to go back into what I was talking about with, you know, the sort of conformity perspective of some of the more conservative sorts on the island. I don't know if you know it, but there was one place to drink on those days, and it was the Harbor House Pub. Mm-hmm. And the Harbor House Pub, as I think I said in my book, was sort of separated into the men's section and the ladies and escorts section. Mm-hmm. So if you were to go into the men's section, there would obviously be just men there, and there was a group of people that were locals that were always there, and they were the ones that you would have gone to if you wanted to find out what they thought about, you know, about the history. And that was sort of where, and it was mixed. I mean, mm-hmm. I said that to a great degree that they were quite understanding. There were those, however, who were not. And there were issues regarding, you know, the long hairs and the people that would attempt to actually, I would say an assault of long hairs in terms of getting them and cutting their hair off, right?
Oh my gosh!
Those issues did happen. There was the odd event where a long-haired fellow would be sort of, I won't say captured, but taken by a group of people and suddenly have his hair shorn.
Wow.
And that didn't last very long because people were not prepared to put up with that. And a case went to court where actually the individuals who did that to a young man were actually found guilty of something. I don't know what the charge was, but so, you know, it wasn't an idyllic place. It had its ups and downs as well.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about the over the course of these interviews, the Harbor House back in those days comes up a lot as kind of being like a little bit rough and tumble, to put it lightly.
It was the pub. I mean, exactly. Anything that could happen in a modern day pub probably happened there as well.
Totally, totally. It's interesting to hear about how different it was when you go by now. Like, the Harbor House is all done up and, like, super nice. They just renovated it. Sure. And then, hearing the stories about how it used to be is really interesting.
Yeah, well, of course, it's not even there anymore, so it's kind of hard. I wish it was, you know, just to go back and take a look around.
Oh, yeah, it's not the same at all. It's kind of sad. I know, I would have loved to have been able to, like, get a window into the how it would have looked originally, but I get a lot of really interesting stories.
Yeah, I'll bet you do.
I have another story about the Harbor House Hotel in its heyday that I just have to share. It's from when I was talking with Hans Hazenboom, and there's even a little cameo from his wife.
The government would not allow you to drink hard liquor in an establishment where they were serving beer. So you had to build a separate lounge away from where the beer parlor was. And that beer parlor, first of all, the old beer parlor that I know still is an establishment where you had a men's and a ladies' site. That you could mix the men and the women, mm-hmm. or the men couldn't sit as singles in the women's or the partner site. Mm-hmm. So there was always a site where you were segregated from the part where the couples could sit. So we would go down there after work and have a couple of beer, or sometimes way too many for some of them. Fights would break out. So that was, I guess, maybe the way that the government set it up, that why they didn't want that mixed where the ladies were sitting in the old pub. And there were fights in those places too, I can tell you that. It's not, and the odd occasion where a guy would walk his horse right into the bar
That's outside of my experience. Yeah. I've never had
But that was the old, you know, that was the old Salisbury Island.
Oh my God.
And people were, just come in there, just walking by with his horse and walk in to have a beer.
That's awesome.
He did get barred.
Eventually.
Horse in a bar. Do you see what I mean about how there was a lot of different things happening on Salt Spring during this time? Part of me wants to add riding a horse into a bar to my bucket list, and the other half of me just feels bad for the horse.
So, my dear, I think we've covered sex, drugs, and rock and roll pretty clearly, and a little bit about Salt Spring.
There was a lot more happening on Salt Spring during this time period. If you want to get really weird, there's history regarding the rise of various meditation cults, communities, I mean, of course, on the island, all part of the rabid appropriation of Eastern mysticism, quote unquote, that marked this era. People seem to view this moment on Salt Spring with great nostalgia, regardless of which side of the flower child debate they were on. It was a historical period where I think people were truly feeling the inevitability of change, of reaching towards a new reality while letting go of the past one, as the entire world expands before them. That's something that I know I feel in our current reality too. I think I'm ready now to share more of my thoughts on this project with you, and luckily we've got one more trip to the island to take together. On the next final episode of The Other Ganges, The Meaning of Change. Drawing threads together, when to end a story and when not to end a story.